Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Later in the show, we'll listen to Great American Folk Show host Tom Brousseau perform with the Grand City's Children's Choir and his visit with its director, Melanie Popejoy. Our longtime friend Tom Ezern will share another of his Plains Folk essays, this one delving into the profound history of the Turtle Mountain Band of Pembina Chippewa. We'll also hear from a young North Dakota author, Lindsay Undland, who has already published two books and has a third on the way. But we open Main Street today with a discussion with Pastor Danny Danowski of the Horace Lutheran Church. We wanted to know about her role as a pastoral leader in light of the recent Southern Baptist Convention vote that rejected a tighter ban on women in pastoral posts. The denomination voted against adding language to its constitution that would have stated that only men could be affirmed or employed as any kind of pastor or elder as qualified by scripture. Pastor Danny, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We gave an introduction on the Southern Baptist Convention's vote that would have primarily excluded women from serving as pastors. How do you feel about that vote that would have essentially banned someone like you from serving?
If that had happened in the ELCA, that would have been a very heartbreaking vote.
And the ELCA is?
Is the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. We are a denomination of the Lutheran Church. And so while I feel the Southern Baptist Church, I understand they have to follow their own polity and beliefs, I would hope that this would be something that they would continue to discern and to be praying about as they minister to people in the future.
This isn't the first time that you've heard arguments
relative
to women not serving in the priesthood or serving as pastors. So what are your thoughts on those arguments that some people bring forward?
Sure. Well, I mean, I am biased, right? I'm a woman. And so as I interpret scripture, I always come back to Mary Magdalene at the tomb on Easter Sunday. It's empty. Jesus isn't there. And she's looking for him. And he greets her and he says, Mary, it's me. He calls her by name. And she gets to be the first person to preach the good news. The first preacher of the good news of Jesus Christ being risen is Mary. And he tells her to go tell other people. And so right there, we have biblical evidence of women being preachers, of being messengers of the good news. Are there other parts of the Bible that would maybe lead some people to think that women don't have a place in the church? Sure. It depends on how those things get interpreted. It is always our duty and responsibility to be reflecting on those and interpreting those very mindfully, understanding the context from which it came so that you don't one for one apply it to exactly what's happening now.
Share what called you,
sure.
What excited you about your pastoral journey.
Absolutely. So I did not grow up going to church. My parents are both Christian. My mom grew up Lutheran. But for my parents, they had both had broken relationships with the church. And so when it came to, do we raise her in the church? They thought, no, because we don't want her to have a repeat experience of what we did. And if it's something she wants, she can find it for herself. And to be honest with you, I don't know if I had been raised in the church, if I would have said, yeah, I do feel called to be a pastor. And I won't ever know that. But I love the journey that I've had. I've been able to explore faith on my own. I started going to church by myself when I was about 16. And my curiosity really just grew. That coupled with I loved community service. I was a very active member of my community service group in high school. And so my best friend belonged to this church that I started going to. And he said, hey, we go on mission trips. Do you want to come with? And I was like, well, that sounds like a week of community service to me. Like, yeah, I'm on board. I'll ask my parents. And my parents said, if you want to, we'll support this, fundraise some of it. And sure. And so I did. And because of the fundraising, I had to be at church more. And my curiosity grew. And my love grew. And whether or not I knew it, my faith was growing. And so before I left for that trip, I decided to get baptized. I was like, this seems like the next right step in this faith that, you know, I've barely dipped a toe into. And so at 17, I was baptized. And at that time, if you had asked me what my plans for the future was, I would have said, oh yeah, I'm going to college. I'm going to start on a pre-dental track. I wanted to be an orthodontist. I shadowed my orthodontist. I was so set on this path. And so when I began to discern a call to ministry, I was like, what is this? I didn't have so much language for it as I do now. And so I sought out my pastor. And so as I was growing up from, 15 through college, I had had only women pastors in my life. And that was extremely influential to me. I never had to question whether or not I could be a pastor. It was more or less like, how do I make this happen? Like, what does this look like for me in my life? And so I got to sit down with my pastor and asked her all sorts of questions, from like, what was seminary like, to what was it like dating outside of your church, or outside of seminary? Like, now that you have this pastoral identity, like, how does your pastoral identity shape all of these other aspects of life? Because it is your whole self. You bring your whole self into ministry. I mean, it's a very beautiful part of ministry. And so what I felt called to and still do is, pastors have this beautiful privilege to walk with people in life's best and worst moments. And that's really sacred. And that for me was like, yes, that is what I feel called to at, what was I, 19 years old? Long story short, left my pre-dental track and ended up applying to seminary instead of dental school, which felt like a really big pivot at the time, but it was the best pivot for my life. My parents were really supportive, and that meant the world to me, because I was like, they're gonna think I'm crazy. But actually, my mom was able to name my gifts for ministry before I could see them for myself, which was really special.
You work side by side with Pastor Will Sappington here at the Horace Lutheran Church. I'm proud to say I'm a member of this church. How does the congregation respond to you, Pastor Danny? I've had my observations. How do you feel this congregation responds to you, being a woman in this leadership role for our church?
Yeah. I'm not the first woman leader that they've ever had, so I'm not paving a way by any means. But I've been nothing but welcomed, and welcomed very warmly. I know that this church, when they were looking to call a second pastor, that they were hoping to call a woman, for that diversity of perspective. And Pastor Will and I are just in different life stages, right? So that brings a different nuance to the way that we see the world and that we share the gospel. So yeah, nothing but warmth and love from the people here.
Have you faced any challenges because you are a woman in your journey to present day while you're here at the church?
I haven't experienced any challenges based on gender here at HLC. I have in other contexts, specifically in seminary. Part of our requirement is to do a chaplaincy internship. And so you're kind of cold calling people, going into their rooms and seeing how they're doing and offering spiritual care or prayer. And I had...
like at a hospital setting?
At a hospital, yes, in a hospital setting in downtown Minneapolis. And I was visiting a patient. She was very sick, but ended up talking a lot with her husband. And he told me, he's like, well, you know you're a sinner, right? And I'm like, actually, yeah, thank you. I do know this. I know I'm a sinner. Thank you. He's like, well, you should really reconsider your call to ministry, because women should not be pastors. And
when you stepped away from that, what did you think?
I thought, I just met this guy. He doesn't know me at all. I was kind of surprised that someone might be so bold to a perfect stranger, understanding that, sure, he has his own convictions, and also his wife is very sick. And so maybe he's not showing up in this space the way that he would maybe like to. He gave me a disc of materials that I could watch to somehow convict me to not pursue this call to ministry. And I...
Materials, yeah, like Bible verses?
Bible verses, a video about creation. And, I just accepted politely and was like, I watched it honestly just to see what kind of material it was. Did it persuade me not to pursue ministry? Well, no, I'm sitting here talking to you. But it, yeah, more than anything, just kind of took me by surprise. In the moment, it also kind of made me feel sad for his wife, not just for her condition, but that if he could be so bold to a stranger, I would hate to think about how he could treat this woman he loves so much. And maybe I know that's me overstepping for sure, but it just kind of made me sad situationally for the whole thing.
We're enjoying our conversation with Pastor Danny Danowski. Following last Wednesday, Southern Baptist vote to reject a proposal that would have imposed stricter measures on congregations with women in pastoral leadership. Back to the Bible, Pastor Danny, when you come across these verses that you cited earlier that may have some think that you're in a man's place, like we just talked about with the gentleman from Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. What goes through your mind? How do you interpret those into present day?
I like to look at the whole, like the big picture about what was happening in that context, and to cherry pick one thing because we agree with it is, in my opinion, not the way the Bible was meant to be used. That we have this whole encompassing narrative, this whole story of God's faithfulness to God's people, and it includes some really beautiful moments, but some hard moments too. I mean, people go through trials and troubles, and that God is steadfast in that. As for how do I approach these, this same text that people like to cite against women, if you keep reading in that, also condones slavery and racism, and how we have been able to say we don't agree with that, or how we would condemn that now and say that that's not the way that we treat people. So we can look and should look at the Bible with this critical lens of just because it fit and suited the context of that day doesn't mean that we have to take everything word for word, carbon copied into our day to day. And that becomes really sticky and really tricky because then you're like, well, how much of it do we, you know, hold on to, or are we manipulating it too much? You know, it becomes this bigger conversation and it is sticky. And so I think that's where denominations take the liberty of saying, okay, this is what we do hold and this is what we don't hold. And so the ELCA is able to say, this is what we hold. I can't speak for the Southern Baptist Church, but there are certainly things, right, that we can say that denominations aren't willing to hold.
Do we know the number of women who serve in the Lutheran Church?
I think the current number is 51% of called ordained ministers in the ELCA are women. At least that was true for me when I was in seminary. That was reflected in our student body. I went to Luther Seminary in St. Paul, and I think we'll continue to see this trend, at least in the ELCA, that it will keep continuing to be primarily women. I was encouraged at 23 to see so many of my classmates, not only as women, but as women who had chosen to pursue this call even after serving other careers or having raised families, to say, no, I want to come back to this thing that God has been putting on my heart for a long time. There were a lot of second career people in my class, which to me just makes me so happy for the church. I have this diverse group of people who are called to share this love of Jesus with the world, and that, yeah, we bring our own expressions to that. And that's not a bad thing. Like, representation matters. From me being able to see a female pastor at 16 years old to now, I'm hoping to be a good example and a good role model here in our congregation, that young girls can see me as a pastor and know that should they feel called someday, like, it is a very real possibility that they can be a pastor too.
You do a wonderful job with the youth in our community
here
at Horace Lutheran Church, as does Pastor Will. Do you provide advice to young women? Have people come to you and asked you about this topic, that I'm a woman, I feel called. Some men may not feel comfortable with women priests. What's your experience? Have you had those opportunities?
I can say I recognized gifts for ministry in our kids here, which is really awesome to see and to say. And so can maybe help plant seeds. No one's ever come to me and said, Pastor Danny, I'm thinking about being a pastor. No one's ever said that to me yet. But if it happened, I'd say, that's great. Tell me more. Like, what do you want to know? How can I be helpful to you as you discern this call? Ministry also can look like a lot of different things. It doesn't have to look or only look like being a parish pastor. There's campus ministry, there's camp ministry, there's chaplaincy, there's this whole plethora of avenues that people can fulfill a call. And so I think I would also encourage them to explore what the broader scope of ministry is. I know a lot of our kids, even when they come back from camp, have this renewed sense of faith, and because they've seen it in a different way, and that inspires them too. I'm of the mind that, like, as long as we're just keeping open conversation and open mind to the possibility that God is, you know, working in someone's life, it's beautiful.
Pastor Danny, what advice would you give to women who feel called to pastoral ministry but face opposition?
Yeah, that would be such a tough spot. I would say definitely keep praying, and not in the, well, if I pray this away, it'll go away. I don't mean it like that. I mean it in a see how the Spirit moves kind of sense.
I'm just thinking there could be some cases where that opposition may be coming from dad or
maybe
grandpa or other, even, you know, mom or aunt.
Sure, sure.
In the family.
And that adds a layer of complexity to how hard it would be to consider your own place of origin, your family, and try to even break away from that. I would say follow your heart. You know, God knows your heart. To follow your heart, as hard as that might be. In my own call story.
Yeah. Your parents stepped back.
Yeah.
And allowed you.
They did. They gave me space.
To have space.
There is more to that, though. My dad was very hesitant in the beginning because he was like, I don't know what this looks like for you to be a pastor. I just don't. And he finally did come around, but it took a little bit. And his advice was, I don't want to hold you back. I want you to follow your heart. Now, I realize that not all parents are going to have that same reaction that my parents did. I'm so grateful for the reaction and the support that I had in my parents. Not all people are going to maybe have that or find that, but I would say follow your heart. God knows your heart. And I would also give them similar advice to people who ask me, how'd you find the Lutheran church? How did you know, you know, you were ELCA, or how do I, I'm
instead
looking
of
for
maybe
this,
an Episcopal priest or something different.
Right. And for me, I kind of just landed in an ELCA church. And I decided to stick around because I heard this message of grace that I'd never heard before, that I really needed to hear as a teenager. I needed to hear that there was grace in the world for me. And so I would tell someone else, go seek something where you get to be your fullest God-given self. That's the place where you're going to flourish, where you're going to find ministry, and you're going to find a community of people who are passionate about Jesus in the way that you are passionate about Jesus. Not some place that's going to ask you to check parts of who you are at the door, but a place that's going to embrace you fully. And I know it's out there because I have found it myself. And even that part of my call story, it taught me that there's not one single path to faith or to the priesthood.
Are there trends that you've noticed, Pastor Danny, or maybe things that other churches can do or that this church has done or can do that fosters a more inclusive environment for women?
I would say that if trying to foster that environment that is inclusive is important to you, be very intentional about it. Ask women what they need or what they would need to feel supported and listen. I would say have diversity in your hiring committee or your call committee, right? My call committee was a diverse group of people who were both men and women, some people who were older. We had a high schooler represented on that committee. And so, again, having this multitude of voices is certainly helpful. And then I would also say, things like maternity leave and that kind of care is important, to have a policy in place, to be willing to pay your female clergy as much as you would a male counterpart. And just, yeah, generally ask people what you need for support and try and meet them where they're at.
As we conclude our conversation, after the Southern Baptists chose not to provide further restrictions against allowing women to be pastors, what message would you like to convey, Pastor Danny, to those who might still support that stance, might be in another denomination that does not allow women in the priesthood? What would you say to them?
I would say keep praying, keep discerning, keep yourself open to the movement of the Holy Spirit, because the Holy Spirit is going to lead and guide all of us in the direction of God's choosing. And so to stay open to that possibility of what can happen.
Pastor Danny Donowski. She works with Pastor Will Sappington at the Horace Lutheran Church and has one of the most beautiful voices I have ever heard.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thanks, Craig.
That was Pastor Danny Donowski of the Horace Lutheran Church. Next, we hear from our longtime friend Tom Ezern with another of his Plains Folk essays. Today, Tom delves into the profound history of the Turtle Mountain Band of Pembina Chippewa as chronicled in John M. Shaw's book, In Order That Justice May Be Done, The Legal Struggle of the Turtle Mountain Band of Pembina Chippewa. This meticulously researched work published by North Dakota University Press sheds light on the enduring light for justice, revealing long-buried truths and celebrating the resilience and leadership of the Chippewa people.
The book is about justice. And it is justice. It has a long title, In Order That Justice May Be Done, The Legal Struggle of the Turtle Mountain Band of Pembina Chippewa, 1795-1905. The editorial team who worked on it at North Dakota State University Press, among themselves, called it the Justice Book. For the author, John M. Shaw, in the conclusion, observes that justice amounts to telling stories that reveal overlooked or long-buried truths. The book is about justice, and it is justice, which word is quoted from the plea of the Chippewa solicitor, John B. Butno, protesting the notorious 10-cent treaty of 1892. So the book is by a white guy, Shaw. It originated as his dissertation at the University of Arizona. He teaches at Portland Community College. Prior to publication by NDSU Press, his work was vetted and recommended by scholars and elders at Turtle Mountain. They say he got the long-buried truth right, and I agree. The Justice Book is a model for serious tribal history. What is the point of rehashing the tawdry history of the failure of the United States government to live up to legal agreements and moral commitments? In one respect, someone of a legalistic bent might say, well, the Indian Claims Commission in 1981 delivered justice to Turtle Mountain in the form of a $52,277,337.97 settlement for lands taken under duress for a pittance. Yes, but there is that other part of justice, the storytelling. Put it into a book, a thick book, with lots of footnotes, and the imprint of a university press. Any questions? Well, there it is. In addition to which, we have the matter of what I call flipping the agency in the story. Here, the Turtle Mountain Chippewa are repeatedly wronged. They suffer starvation and dispossession, but they are never victims. They have persistent intergenerational leadership, Little Shell times three. They have articulate advocates like Butno, and they have good faith. They accept an unwelcome relationship imposed by the United States government, wardship, and they work with it. Keep on, despite what Shaw summarizes as the bad faith and disruptive tactics of federal officials and the avaricious aggression of white intruders and their politicians like Congressman William Pettigrew. In white guy terms, the Chippewa held the land by Indian title, which did not protect it from appropriation. Realistic native diplomats knew this would happen and sought realistic and reasonable settlements. They wanted a reservation, a tract sufficient to secure a future for their posterity, and they wanted just compensation for relinquishing their title to the balance of lands they held. They seemed to lose on both counts, for the 10-cent treaty did offer only a pittance, and it stipulated a reservation of only two townships. At every stage, though, Shaw documents, analyzes, and, yes, judges. His work on the Old Crossing Treaty of 1863 is just breathtaking. I have never read such deep and perceptive commentary on treaty proceedings in the West. Shaw's work is a homily for historians. He tells us, give up your preoccupation with the periods and rationales of federal policy. They're all willful and mercurial. Anyway, focus on the native side in the manner of a chronicle. Tell the story. The work is an exhortation, too, for a rising generation of indigenous leaders. Persistence, realism, character for the long durée can produce palpable results and preserve a people's dignity. Miigwech, Dr. Shaw.
That was our friend Tom Easern, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and a longtime contributor to Prairie Public. Next, Great American Folk Show host Tom Brousseau revisits a composition from his childhood. That's after this. That was our friend Tom Easern, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and a longtime contributor to Prairie Public. Next, Great American Folk Show host Tom Brousseau revisits a composition from his childhood. That's after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, specializing in helping new and established investors hit their goals from single family to commercial investing. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this excerpt from the Great American Folk Show, show host Tom Brousseau revisits a composition from his childhood.
North Dakota's centennial was in 1989, and I remember it so fondly. I was a kid at Viking Elementary. Back then, Miss Wharton taught folk songs in class. Folk songs like John Henry and Low Bridge, the Erie Canal song, and Guantanamera and Scarborough Fair, and also a brand new North Dakota song written especially for the centennial, one entitled Winter Skies was composed by Michael Kopelman. He was a local kid. Looking back on it now, the centennial was a time of patriotic renewal, and folk music played a big part of the celebration's canvas. Recently, I hosted a benefit concert for the Grand Forks Children's Museum at the historic Empire Theater. It was a great time, and we all helped raise some pretty good money for the new museum. One of the acts featured Melanie Popejoy and members of the Grand Cities Children's Choir. It was extra special for me because I got to sing with them, and extra special because we sang Winter Skies. And what fun it is to be reunited with a composition from one's youth.
No sea to shining sea, or purple mountains majesty, grace, North Dakota plains, but spacious skies there are, clean air and countless shining stars, mile after mile of amber lakes of green, North Dakota harvest moon, your autumn
regarding all of the young faces of the Grand Cities Children's Choir on stage at the benefit concert that night, I couldn't distinguish myself from them, not in the sense that my voice got lost in their voices, but rather we melded into one another to make something greater than the parts alone. They were blue, and I was red, and as we sang, we became purple. Music is powerful like that. Melanie Popejoy, who played the piano that night, is the Associate Director of Choral Activities at the University of North Dakota. That's just one of many hats that she wears. She's also the Director of the Grand Cities Children's Choir. And in preparing for the benefit show, I had the pleasure of getting together with her to rehearse and discuss the text of Winter Skies. And it quickly became evident to me that she would have some very insightful things to share about folk music. You're originally from the Ozarks.
I am. I'm from central Missouri.
That's kind of the spot in the United States where we think about folk music.
Yes. As Louis Armstrong once said, folk music is music of the folk. And I am related to many folk. My grandmother came from a family where her father, he loved music. And the expectation at night was the family would sit in a circle, and each one of them trained on a particular instrument. But as they grew, they had to know how to play the next instrument in the circle. And at some point, they would do an evening full of music, and every song, they played a different instrument. I have this folk music within me.
Your take on folk music, to keep it alive, do you see that we're doing that as a society, that we're actually carrying on that flame?
I believe that there's such a broad band of musical offerings. And what I see with young people is I see a new embracing of folk music that might, and folk styles. And I think if the students hear these young artists with folk stylings, that I think it leads them deeper into it and they get back to the real authentic music that our country was raised on.
It doesn't really take that much to get you, back there. And once you're back there, you get the bug for it.
You do.
And you want to know about these songs and these voices and these people.
Yes.
And what it is that they're singing about and where they're singing about. It's pretty interesting stuff, isn't it?
It's fascinating. And I see more and more young people, even through what they call indie folk artists, that's where it begins for them. And we talk about what is it about that music? It's the simplicity of it. It's that it tells a story. Well, then that will back you up to artists of the, 70s and 80s, 60s, 70s and 80s, that they connect to that, and then they want to go back farther.
Right.
So I see a kind of a resurgence of an interest in folk music.
North Dakota winter skies, it took till now to realize that I love you and will till I die.
I'm going to ask you to perform with me today, Winter Skies.
It's such a magical piece. We're talking about 7th, 8th, and 9th graders. We're talking about probably the most angstiest time in their lives. They don't like a whole lot of things, or they won't tell you they like a lot of things. And when we started out singing, "No sea to shining sea or purple mountain majesty, grace North Dakota plains," we took that sentence by itself and just discussed it. What does that mean? Well, we might not have seas. We don't have oceans surrounding us. We don't have purple mountain majesties. It starts out about talking about the things that we do see in our country that we as a country think are beautiful. But spacious skies there are, and countless shining stars. Oh, now we're digging into what does make us special.
North Dakota summer.
I saw the people in the room change immediately. And from night one that we first introduced the song, there was a connection. There was a sense of pride. And from that magic moment, I try to keep this piece in our repertoire, because wherever we go, it gives others a picture of who we are as a state and part of this beautiful country. And for a group of people that don't like a lot of things, they sure love this song. And it has become a favorite. They want to sing it again and again.
Well, if you don't mind getting behind that beautiful piano, I'm gonna see if I can sing this song with you today. Would you mind playing it?
I would love that.
All right. North Dakota plains.
your autumn afternoons have put the shine in my eyes. North Dakota winter skies, it took till now to realize that I love.
Our thanks to Tom Brousseau for that excerpt from the Great American Folk Show, which airs Saturdays at 5 p.m. right here on Prairie Public.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Now we introduce Lindsay Endland. She's just a junior in high school, but has already published two books with a third on the way. Lindsay Endland, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're sure welcome. We're glad that you were here, Lindsay. You are a young author. I say young because you've been writing for quite a long time, since fifth grade. What got you serious about writing, Lindsay? What appealed to you about it?
It was the world around me and the experiences that I had at the time with school basketball and traveling basketball. The people around me, observing the world around me and just seeing the people around me is really what inspired me to get my story out there.
I wouldn't equate basketball or traveling basketball with writing. What caused you then to start putting the pen to the paper?
It was just, I think, for me, it was getting my emotions out at first, and then once I had this 300-page document, I was like, well, I'm sure other people would relate to this, to something like this, so I just decided I'll self-publish it, and then it came this. So
yeah, tell me about that. The series is called Priders. First, why the title?
It's just something, like, it's an award. Prider is someone who is the pride of the town, basically. They make the town look good, basically.
So how did you come to decide what it is you wanted to write about? You're writing fiction, correct? I mean, you could have went many different ways with that decision. What caused you to decide to write about what you'd like to write about?
I've just always written about high school dramas. It's just something that I can't really write anything else. I'm very in my lane about that. It's just writing about high school drama has always been something I've done since an early age because it's just always been interesting to me. People are very interesting. So
how many books have you written so far, Lindsay?
I've written two, but I'm currently working on my third book now.
How has the feedback been from your high school peers since you're kind of writing about you guys' life, right?
Yeah, kind of. For me and like my school, my classmates have grown up with me being an author, so it's nothing that out of the ordinary for them. So they don't really care, but it's not in a bad way. They're just used to it.
Mm-hmm. Tell me the process that you use for writing. You're going to be a junior in high school. You've got a busy life. You're like athletics. When do you find time to write books?
My schedule is I write on the weekends. And on those weekends, I'll write 3 pages a day. And each day that I have off, like during school, if I have like a vacation day off, like a 3-day weekend, I'll write those 3 days and that'll be 9 pages.
Do you have a goal each day? Every time you sit down, you want to write 3 pages? Is that kind of your goal? How'd you come about 3 pages? What does that mean?
So 1 page is, of course, too little for me to get anything done. Then 5 was too much for me because I tried different schedules. And then 3 was right in the middle and it was just perfect for my motivation and, you know, to prevent burnout for me.
Sure. Do you have your stories worked out in advance, Lindsay, when you start writing for, I guess, a chapter or maybe even a book? Or does the inspiration come to you as you write?
For my first book, it was kind of, you know, on the fly. But with the second book, I did plan it out, like, completely. But I didn't exactly like that because it was too constricting to me. So I do a little bit of both now. I plan out some of the, like, I have main events. And then as I go through the book, I fill in the plot points between those main events, you know, on the fly. So
who are you writing for, Lindsay? Adults? Teenagers? Who's your main group there?
I write for teenagers, middle schoolers, high schoolers, and any athlete that wants to pick up my book.
What do you hope that middle schoolers and high schoolers or athletes take from your work? What are you trying to inspire them to do or be?
So there's not exactly like a takeaway from it. It's more of just, it's supposed to be something that teenagers can relate to, not necessarily a message or anything.
Almost like entertainment, if you will?
Yeah, basically. Something to be relatable, not necessarily a message or takeaway.
Tell me now about one of the main characters in your series, Callie Horn. Who is she? And what's her journey in the Prider series?
Callie Horn is just me in the sense that she's quite moody and drawn back from the world. She prefers to be in the background as well. And well, throughout the series, she's thrown into instances where she needs to be in the spotlight. She has the help of her other friend, Ray. In the end, she'll be thrown into a situation where she's all on her own, but she learns to accept it.
Yeah. Did you tell me she's kind of like you? Are you kind of withdrawn?
I'm a very introverted person.
In your book, Spiral, you have topics of kidnapping and murder. Were those hard for you to write about? And what was the inspiration behind those plot lines?
I mean, it was pretty easy to write about. It's something I've grown up on, horror movies and stuff. The idea behind Spiral is that the best player can get away with murder. And I just kind of thought that would be a cool spin on words, but, you know, take it literally instead of figuratively. So.
I don't want to play against that player, Lindsay. I'll tell you that. How do you balance then the elements of, I guess, of mystery? And then high school, you called your books kind of dramas, high school drama in your books. Is there a balance there? Is that easy for you to kind of write about?
I mean, yeah, I do lots of symbolism, and also the characters are just actual teenagers. They act like, you know, your regular teenagers in real life instead of the Hollywood high school teenagers. So there's realistic teenagers, but they're not, you know, in a normal setting, if that makes sense.
Sure. We're enjoying our conversation with Lindsay Undland. She'll be a junior in high school this coming year. She lives here in North Dakota. She's written 2 books in the Priders series so far, Stolen and Spiral. What challenges have you faced, Lindsay, when you're writing? Do you ever get writer's block?
I do get writer's block, and especially I do have issues with motivation. Some days I'll wonder why I'm still writing, but then I remember all how far I've come with writing, and it just motivates me more. But if I can't write on a day, like if I have no motivation to write at all, I'll force myself to write like at least a page or 2 pages and then fix what I have later. So
you said initially you were self-published. Do you have a publisher now, Lindsay?
I was self-published at first. I self-published through Kindle Direct Publishing at first. And then in October 2021, Julie Brand, she's based out of Nashville, Tennessee with W Brand Publishing. And she picked me up through Facebook. So she found me instead of me going out and finding a publisher. So
Where do you sell your books, Lindsay?
I sell my books on Amazon, Main Street Books in Minot, Barnes & Noble in Minot, and Amazon.
You say some days you have challenges, but you also get rewards from writing. What is the most rewarding experience thus far in your writing career?
Being able to get into schools and talk with the students and talk with the student bodies in schools, and just traveling and getting my story out and stuff like that.
What do you tell students when you talk to them about writing?
I tell them about my experiences with sports, and then I tell them how I took my experiences and created a book with it. So I tell them how to, you know, begin writing, and then I'll tell them the challenges and everything like that.
Your next book, I think, is titled Split. Is that right?
Yep.
Give us a tease. What's it going to be about?
Kelly and Ray face a new threat that's taking advantage of the talents of athletes. That's what I'll say.
Ah, okay. That'll be an interesting read, I think. What are your future plans? Where do you think writing will take you, Lindsay?
Well, I'm not too sure. I hope that writing could become a career for me, but you know, you have to be pretty lucky for that. But I plan to just get an English degree after high school and maybe work somewhere.
Do you know where you're going to college yet, Lindsay?
Not quite yet. Mm-hmm. I still haven't thought about it.
All right. Besides writing and golf, what else do you like to do? What hobbies do you have?
Basically, I just draw and play games on my computer. That's really the only hobbies that I have.
Tell me your go-to video game.
Right now, it's Planet Crafter. That's...
Lindsay, it's a pleasure that you spoke to us today. You are going to be a junior at Mohall MLS. You've written two books so far, Stolen and Spiral, in the Prider series, with a third one, Split, on its way. Thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Yep, of course.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 2 is about learning and storytelling. It states, traditional teaching and the passing on of knowledge and wisdom was done through storytelling, song, ceremony, and daily way of life, often incorporating specific gender and age-specific responsibilities. These continue to be some of the best modes for learning for both Native and non-Native learners. In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to JT Shining Oneside, enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of the Chippewa Nation, as she shares Francis Cree's story of the Sweat Lodge.
Francis Cree, Old Eagle Heart, from Dunseith, he shared how we got the Sweat Lodge. He told me this story when I was visiting him, and like a lot of the elders that I learned from, including my parents and my grandfather, they could be talking to you about anything, and then all of a sudden a story would come in, something important. So you just always had to be ready. I remember him saying there was this man that went out because the people were having a hard time, and he asked in the woods. He said, I want to get help for my people because they're really having a hard time. He prayed and he fasted. He looked up there and he seen this bird in the nest and told him, I have been listening to your prayer and listening to you asking for help for your people. I'm honoring your request and I'm going to help your people now. But you will have to respect the gift that you are given from me, and I'll continue to help your people.
I'm Sharla Stever. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org. Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are grateful that you have spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll visit with Anton Troyer, who has just released his first novel, Where Wolves Don't Die. The book explores themes of masculinity, living with nature, family secrets, and race relations. We hope you can join us again tomorrow right here on Main Street,